WSHU's Join the Conversation series is sponsored by IKEA New Haven and the Wyand Cimbali Group.
What a great event. And for all you people who got here early, I hope you enjoyed ingesting all those chemicals, right? Because those really were chemicals. And that's part of what we're here to talk about is all those really good for you chemicals in the whole food plant-based diet. T. Colin Campbell, PhD, who laid out in his last best-selling book, The China Study, why all those chemicals in a whole food plant-based diet are good for you. Now, the new book, Whole, Rethinking the Science of Nutrition, he's going to be talking about tonight, lays out the science behind those hows and whys. And also he talks about the economic and political factors that he believes could be standing in the way of that science. And of course, very timely with a farm bill being debated hotly at times in Washington, D.C., and with Connecticut just weighing in on labeling of GMO crops. So here he is, Dr. T. Colin Campbell. Please welcome him.
Thank you so much, Mark. I also would like to start in by thanking Gillian Anderson and her NPR crew for having me here, and also thank Jody Gould for making those wonderful arrangements for my trip down. And finally, I would like to thank all of you for coming out to this lecture. I hear tell that Connecticut is a fairly well-educated state, and it's nice to be speaking to such an audience. That I'm sure are very socially conscious, high level of education, you know, as your background. My charge here, of course, is to talk about nutrition health. I've been in this field for a long time. If I count back the numbers, it's been 57 years ago when I started my graduate work at Cornell University. And as many of you know, I started out with some ideas, mostly told to me by my professors at the time. It started with some ideas that actually eventually I had to challenge in a fairly major way. And after all these years, now I find myself on the other side of the fence, quite a ways away. So as I went through the years with lots of students and colleagues, wonderful people, most of which were at Cornell University, I obviously ran into things from time to time that I called heresies. If I didn't call them heresies, at least my colleagues did. And so I kept stumbling across ideas that were not exactly in accord with what was in a textbook or what I was taught, or what, in fact, I was actually teaching in the early part of my career. So my career was sort of punctuated along the way by just seeing sort of one odd thing after another until finally I realized, looking back, that those so-called heresies told a different story. They described a different world, a different paradigm, a different worldview. And so these days, I like to call those heresies principles. So in any case, my background, of course, is in research, biomedical research, most of which was funded by the National Institutes of Health. That is to say, you taxpayers did this. I didn't get my support from industry. And so I feel like, in many ways, because the American taxpayer paid for our research, and generously so over the years, I feel a great deal of responsibility to come back to tell the American public what did we do with their money. In any case, let me then walk through. There's a lot of difficulties with nutrition, as I'm sure you know. Nutrition is a kind of a mishmash of ideas. People have all different kinds of views about what this is, you know, what kind of food they should consume. It's culturally biased oftentimes. People have very strong opinions about what, in fact, is good nutrition and what it's not. I just want to walk through, especially from my scientific background, I want to walk through a little bit and just sort of lay out for you some of the thoughts that have occurred to me when I think about, over these many years, when I think about, you know, the challenge we have in understanding this very important topic. And I do have to say, I'm really quite passionate about what I think we learned. I think it has a lot to offer. In fact, I have to be kind of careful. I'm supposed to be a scientist, be objective, but also have to admit that this is kind of a personal thing in a way, too, because it works. It simply works. And I can't stand back and always argue for more research when, in fact, I already know it it really works well. So let me, if you can give me the first slides then. How do you like my title? So I want to change the paradigm, if you will, and one way to change the paradigm is go back and borrow a word that characterizes the way we now live our medical lives, a word that's generally well accepted, and use that word to, in fact, sort of get me into the door of talking about something a little bit different than what just relying on drugs is all about. Let me start here, just first. Describe, I mean, the problem that we have now today is big. It's big. It's complex. There's so many faces to this problem. I'm sure all of you really can appreciate this. And so this is just one way. I actually just got this off the web, one of the recent graphic presentations of what this is about. And all of you really know this. Because ultimately, this discussion about nutrition does, in fact, in real life, relate to health care, which I rather call disease care, not health care, as far as our system is concerned. So let's look at the top chart there, and you can see that the cost, the per capita spending for health care costs, just have a starting point in this particular graph, let's say in around 1992 or so, was just under $4,000 a person. Now, in a year or so hence, it's up to $12,000. I mean, that's a pretty steep increase. And to get a better picture of what that really is about, as you can see here in the bottom chart, here is the comparison of the rise in national health care costs per capita, the rise in health care costs, the rate of increase, if you will, compared to the rate of increase, the rate of change in compared to the consumer price index, which describes better our whole society. And you can see that whereas it was more or less even, the health care costs, the rise in health care costs in 1970 was more or less equivalent to the general inflation rate or the consumer price index. Now, look at it. It's 18.8 times what it is in 1970. And see that spread there? It's even more now, two or three years later. This is 2005. Anyone can look at this. We're breaking the bank. This is going in a direction that's destructive. It is simply destructive. It's serious. And so our entire health care cost bill, we can't seem to bring it under control. We can't seem to bring it under control. Lots of argument and debate, and that so-called debate we had in the U.S. Congress two or three years ago, I consider it more of a shouting match, not really a debate. And so what I want to then now address, something that got left out of this discussion. Something got left out of this discussion. So here's how to, my interpretation at least, of how I think we might solve this problem. Let's start off by understanding nutrition. I'm going to argue that as far as understanding nutrition is concerned, we don't understand it. And I'm talking about the public at large. I'm talking about the professionals as well. I'm talking about the practitioners in medicine, as well as the in my trade, in biomedical research. We really don't understand it. So let's start off and understand it. And I want to basically help you to at least or share my view what I think that might be. So understanding nutrition, quite frankly, improves health far more than any of us, I think, really realize. I know for myself, I had no idea when I got involved in nutritional biochemistry now more than a half century ago, I had no idea at that time that nutrition was as important as it really is. I mean, it's just really quite dramatic, and we'll get to that a little bit later. So in this healthcare debate, if we look at it in a sort of a context, a larger arena, in a sense, what the healthcare debate really involves, as many of you know, whether it's on the right side of the congressional aisle or on the left side, it doesn't make much difference. What they were talking about at that time and what we as a society talked about was who's going to pay the bill? That's really what the nature of all these proposals were. They pretended to be different, and they were different in some details. But in reality, they were only talking about who was going to pay the bill. I don't think that I can't find any serious discussion about one way to bring health care costs under control is lessen the demand for disease care services. Some people call this health care services. I call it disease care services. So that's just a basic fundamental ABC's economic model. Let's decrease demand and do it that way. So now let me get to the question. What is so notable about nutrition? What do we think about when we think of that particular word? First off, we know this, as I already said. Public is massively confused. I lecture quite a bit, have for many, many years, and I'm really struck by the almost bipolar opposites in the views that people have about the subject. It also, as I say, is very personal. Here's another sort of backgrounder, bit of information that we have to keep in mind, and I've already alluded to it. Namely, professionals are not educated in nutrition. You know there's not a medical school in this country that really teaches nutrition? Not one. Yes, there's a few that have an elective, and some of the students will take the elective, and the elective at most is about maybe 10, 15 hours. My gosh, we take 200 to 300 hours just for an undergraduate in nutrition. So medical schools are not teaching nutrition. My son, Tom, who did the book China Study with me, co-authored it, at the time was an actor from Chicago. I often reminded him his training in acting probably is going to serve him well in medicine. But in any case, he got enthused about what he was doing, working with me, decided to go back to medical school, and then now he's just one more month is finishing up his specialty in family medicine with his MD. And it turns out that the reason I bring his name up in part is because in his training in medical school, he had one session, 2 hours long, on nutrition. And that was it. That was it. And the person who actually was lecturing at the time said that Jane Brody was his favorite nutritionist. I happen to know Jane Brody. She's a graduate of Cornell. And she was not taking nutrition. She's a journalist. Nothing to say about Jane Brody, but anyhow, he thought Jane Brody. And then he concluded that what you really need to do, he was a Scotsman, is to be sure and have a pork chop three times a week. So now let's move on to this little background. And I want now to share with you some original thoughts of my own about why this? I mean, why are we so confused about nutrition? Why do we study it the way we do? Why do we tell the public the way we do? Why do we ignore it? And I'm going to suggest there's two basic assumptions that are flawed, really flawed. And it's fundamental to our narrative. It's fundamental to the way we think, whether we're lay people or professionals or what have you. Flawed assumption number one, protein is grossly overemphasized. And I really mean that. I want to show you just in a few minutes that I have here, just a sample of some observations that mostly came from my own laboratory, at least early on. And this study here, how many people have read the China study? Quite a few. Now, how many have not? That'll give me a better picture. Okay, so in any case, my early research started when I was in the Philippines helping to coordinate a nationwide program of feeding malnourished children and discovered, or I thought I discovered, that in fact, although the country at large, and the children in particular, were not consuming as much protein as we did, I thought, well, you know, that's not me, but my colleagues thought too, they need to get more protein. But what I learned pretty quickly on was with my medical colleague. My medical colleague, a surgeon, actually, by practice, he was telling me of some young children dying of primary liver cancer. And that's supposed to be for middle to old age people, and we told this one day on the golf course, and I didn't pay too much attention, but it registered. And then I started learning a little bit more and finding out that the few children who are consuming the higher levels of protein actually were the ones most likely to get liver cancer. Now, it was all anecdotal, it's not really published, it's not really good science, all that sort of stuff, but it's in my head, I'm thinking. So that's really what started my career for the next 27 years, looking at that question. How come high protein increases liver cancer? That was the model we used, and we learned a lot from that. In any case, here's the original publication that actually was published, too, by some Indian workers at that time that supported what I thought I was seeing in the children. Namely, when they fed rats, in this particular case, that were genetically modified, genetically initiated, we can say those words these days, when they genetically initiated liver cancer in these rats and then fed them two different levels of protein, high and low, you can see the animals fed the higher levels, 100% got the tumors, ones fed the lower. Really a big difference. I didn't need a statistician actually to decide whether or not that was significant. It was really interesting. And so that's really what led to my first NIH grant that then was to Consendium for the next 27 years. And it was that idea, trying to, you know, understand, is that really true? And that we went through the years, and that's where I started running some heresies, and you'll see why in a moment. So increasing protein, increasing cancer, what a thought. What a thought. Then, still today, the most awesome of all nutrients in the minds of many, causing the most feared of all diseases. If that isn't provocative, I don't know what is, actually. So I want to share with you just a couple little observations here, some of the more significant ones we got over the years. Namely, that if we took animals and followed them for the first 12 weeks after the genetic initiation and fed them two different levels of protein, fed them regular higher levels of protein, the levels that recommended, you can see these cancers are starting to grow rather well for during those first first 12 weeks. But then we did this. Then things started getting exciting because in this particular case, we said, well, what happens if we start feeding them those high level and then switch them to low protein diet? The cancer process got turned off and then turned on, turned off. We did this in many different ways. It was very exciting because it turned out that the cancer progresses. It starts with a genetic alteration or mutation, if you will, but it progresses as a function of, in this particular case, the level of protein consumed. And then we went on to look at other nutrients and other cancers and so forth and so on. It just basically led to one of my first heresies, later turning out to be a lesson or a principle: nutrition controls cancer growth. Exciting idea, because most people think, oh, cancer comes from genes, or cancer is caused by viruses, or cancer is caused by chemical carcinogens. To some extent, all those things play a role. But no one's really thinking about nutrition controlling, essentially, this disease. So then it turned out, one more heresy, it turned out the protein we were using, and I didn't pay that much attention those days, it turned out the protein we were using was the one that was most readily available to us researchers. It was cheap enough, plenty of it. It was casein, the main protein of cow's milk. Get that. When we actually fed two different levels of plant protein, two different kinds of plant protein, soy and wheat, it did not increase this, even when fed at the higher levels. So all of a sudden, it's emerging here now. This animal-based protein is turning this cancer on. These two plant proteins are not. That was another thought that we went on to explore in great depth over the years. So we got another lesson here. Casein is the most, this statement here, still people don't want to talk about it. Casein is the most relevant carcinogen ever identified. This raises some really provocative questions, I know, for any of you in science or any of you in medicine. How can I say that? Carcinogens are chemicals, foreign chemicals. That's what causes cancer and so forth and so on. But using the criteria, using the rules of the game, on how we determine those chemicals causing cancer, using that, I can make that conclusion. Now, there's more to be said than I can say here about this, but let me just leave you that thought. And so at this particular point in time, I'm saying to myself, wait a minute, this is not exactly the way I grew up. In fact, I was raised on a dairy farm. Here's me here, 8 or 9 years ago or so, right in the front. So I was raised on a dairy farm. My father was a dairy farmer. My grandfather, all the way back, we're farmers. And, milking cows until I went away to school. Milking cows was justified in part because it was a rich source of protein. At least what I heard. I didn't even know what protein was, to be honest about it. But in any case, milk was valuable for that reason. And then I went off to school at Cornell University in those years there doing my doctoral dissertation with that technical title, which really means I was trying to figure out, how could we make more efficient the production of protein? And basically, the production of high-quality protein. You know, animal-based protein, that's what we were working toward. That was my charge, trying to figure out how we could do that. It really became kind of a biochemical kind of experiment, really quite exciting. But so, both personally and professionally, I was coming from a background where protein was worshipped, and where, in fact, I got immersed in the whole idea, as everyone else did, we got to get more protein, essentially, and figure out better ways to do that. That's why I say that, oh, yeah, that's me. Okay, let's say, put an animal protein. So, in any case, based on, in my very limited time here, I can't show you more than I've shown you, but we studied it, just suffice to say, we studied it in many different ways. And one of the questions that came up, in those experiments, they later got expanded to other considerations, other kinds of outcomes, was it heart disease, cancer, whatever. It turns out the relationship between protein consumption as a percent of protein in the diet, when you look at the relationship between protein, the dietary protein, and let's say a whole host of different adverse health effects, let's say cancer, because this is what we actually saw this curve. It actually existed in those studies we were doing. Protein fed up to about 10% or so of the diet. Even in animals that had been genetically programmed to get cancer, it did not turn on the cancer. It says this. Protein is an essential nutrient. Yes, it is. It's very, very important. We have to have protein, period. Otherwise, we die. We need protein. But what we're really, what I've discovered that we're really talking about here, it was protein fed in excess where the problems arise. And what do we do as a population? 95% of us, at least, or more, consume protein in excess of what is recommended. So we're up here in this territory, up in the danger zone. So that shape of that curve, I can't overemphasize this enough, the shape of that curve, this threshold, if you want to call it that, really said something very profound. I want to share with you what that really is. Because what it says is that, for one thing, this turns out to be the level that has been recommended for 43, since 1943, by other means. The National Academy of Sciences, you know, reproduce this information, going back and re-examining the data every 5 years, have another look, and it turns out the recommendation for protein is around 10%. Actually, it's even higher than what the requirement is. The requirement is around 6.5, 6.7%. And it was kind of jacked up to 10% to make sure everybody got enough. So 10% is enough. That's the ideal level of protein. Instead, we're living up here where the mean protein intake is around 17-18%, accounted for by the fact that 70% of our total protein is provided by animal-based foods. Okay? So now, look at the shape of that. Here's a thought that occurred. Basically, it turns out when we're talking about classes of foods, it turns out a diet made up of plant-based foods, vegetables, fruits, grains, legumes, stuff like that, that has just about 10% protein, almost ideal. And then it already becomes available, too, we become aware. Plant-based foods have all the protein we need. And that's a shock to a lot of people because going back to 1839, when protein first discovered, for a long time people thought, and still, unfortunately, people these days, they think protein means meat. They think it's just, the protein in cow's milk. And so they tend to think that protein only comes from meat. Same thing. No, it's not true. There's plenty of protein present in plant-based foods, and that's really the ideal. Now I want to go one step further. I'm focusing on one nutrient here, protein. But as we worship this idea, the more protein, the better, and we also think, oh, the protein comes from meat, this is what's happened over the last decades and centuries, actually. As we emphasize protein, we recognize it comes from animal-based foods. We start eating more and more animal-based foods. It's not just protein that changes. It's a whole host of just countless other nutrients that also changes. And it turns out all these other nutrients, when added together to the effect of protein, it's that totality and comprehensive effect of all the nutrients, those that are going up that shouldn't go up, and those that are going down because we're consuming the wrong food. The totality of the effect is really what makes this remarkable effect of protein. So let's move on here. I'm going to show you quickly. When I talk about the other kinds of nutrients, here's a kind of a breakdown, the nutrient compositions with respect to some groups of nutrients. Antioxidants, wonderful class of nutrients. Wonderful. They're only produced by plants. Antioxidation, it basically stops the excessive oxidation in our bodies. It's associated with aging, associated with cancer, associated with heart disease. These antioxidants, it stops the rusting of our bodies. Excessive oxidation is rusting. So we need to consume these. complex carbohydrates, we need these two. It's also a source of energy, but when it's done as nature provided it, we consume it that way, we get a good source of energy. Also, these are very good, too, to maintain, in particular, gastrointestinal health for all kinds of different reasons. Vitamins, I'm saying, only made by plants. I know there's people in here who want to argue with me about that, but I say that on the basis of the original definition of what a vitamin is. Namely, it's a chemical we must consume because we can't make it. And so there's some language there that's gotten messed up, but let me just offer to you that these three substances here, that's good stuff. That's really where the health is, all from plants. And then plants also, this basically is whole food plant-based diet, for example. It has a level of fat and protein that's just about right, according to the evidence we now have. In contrast, look what animal foods are. They don't have any antioxidants, really, unless the animals were eating antioxidants before they were slaughtered. They don't make complex carbohydrates. They don't really have any of these classical vitamins that I'm talking about. Unless, again, they were eating those foods that got them there. And in turn, the animal-based foods, on average, have levels of protein and fat that are pretty exorbitant, up into that territory I just described a moment ago. So this nutrition effect, we started out with protein. Okay, we studied that, looked at it carefully. That's good science, we thought. Let's look at this really carefully. But as we passed in time, I had to ask questions about other nutrients that also change in response to our attempt to get enough protein. So I got a third class of foods here that have become prominent, especially since the Second World War, and I guess maybe before that, call them processed foods. Processed foods are a mess, to put it mildly. Processed foods oftentimes are made up of plant food constituents. Like just to give you an example, if we take the refined flour in plants, take the flour out and refine it. We take the sugar out. Let's say we get some of the oil out of plants, right? And so we got some sugar and white flour and oil, all from plants. Sounds good, right? Put it all together, we got a donut or Danish. So I'm not talking about that. These processed foods are manipulative products from the corporate sector and basically organized to attend to our hedonistic pleasures of taste, really what it comes down to. So we get caught up in consuming these kind of foods. Their nutrient composition is terrible. And so the way I look at this, there's three classes of foods: animal-based foods, processed foods, and plant-based foods. Now I could spend the rest of my life, and there's a few more lives, I guess, talking about the difficulties with animal-based foods and processed foods. I don't particularly want to talk about negative things that much anymore because the positive side of this discussion is so exciting. When we're consuming plants, whole plant-based foods, the results that we get are remarkable. So I want to leave with you the idea. Let's focus on the positive side of this. So that was the first assumption, too much reverence for protein. Second assumption is flawed. Namely, we always talk about nutrition basically as a bunch of independent nutrient activities, and nutrition collectively is a summation of these independent nutrient activities. That's a flaw. But I was doing that in my research. I actually served on panels to judge who else was to get research, if you will, evaluating things. And, you know, that's what we do in science. We think science is best done when we actually identify exactly what it is we're working with. And then we look at the numbers and chemical structure and we become really specific. We focus on one thing at a time. And that's what I mean by doing that, and that's a mistake. It's useful in one sense, but it's not useful in another sense, and I'll get to that in a moment. I mean, for example, here's what the public thinks about nutrition. I mean, our recommended intakes of nutrients, called a recommended dietary allowances, I think you're pretty familiar with that. This is just, you know, dietary reference intake for thiamine, riboflavin, all these vitamins, for example. You see how they're each individually named? And then we publish data to show you need 22 milligrams of this or you need 75 milligrams of that. And there's always, you know, it gives a sense of certainty. It gives a sense of science. This is wrong. It's simply wrong to give that kind of focus to those kinds of things. Here's what else we do. In food labeling, we list all these individual nutrients on the side of the package. Not that that's not useful. I was actually on the so-called expert panel that came up with this revision in the early 1990s. But in any case, we ended up shortening what had previously been much larger. In any case, we still focus on individual nutrients. We say this food is good because it's got all this vitamin C. And this one over here is basically not quite as good, has a little bit less. When we don't even know, when you put the food in your mouth, we have no idea how much vitamin C, for example, might be in that spoonful of food or forkful of food that we ate. So this whole idea of talking about nutrition labeling is not as clear as what one might think. It's okay, let's keep it in order because it does give us some information on the kind of foods we consume. But there's a bigger story here. Just eat whole plant-based foods. This whole idea, you know, of working in individual nutrients, we think of it, individual chemicals, that's sort of like the future. I've heard that. I mean, people actually say that someday we're not going to have to eat food. You know, all we need to do is get all those good nutrients out there and put it in a little pill, and that's the way to go. I mean, people have actually said that. I don't know what planet they're walking on, but they certainly are saying those kind of things. In any case, that kind of thinking, one nutrient at a time, led to an industry called the vitamin supplement industry, or the nutrient supplement industry. Nutrient supplement industry, which now has been full force on for about 25 years, maybe 30 years. And I was very much involved in the early stages of that, not on the side of the industry. I was actually asked by the Federal Trade Commission to evaluate the claims were being made at that time. So I followed this industry, and I took issue with it at that time, and I take issue with it these days. Nutrient supplements, the collection of individual nutrients that are supposed to be doing wondrous things for us, does not. It does not. We have had now a number of years where we've had, you know, upwards of 50, 60, 70 individual studies that have been conducted. Look at this nutrient, that nutrient, something else. And the results we're getting, they don't work. Not in the long term. We may see early on, we may see changes that we rather like for some of these things, like it goes up in the blood or it does this or does that. And that kind of thing, if we're deficient, that seems like a good idea. And so it led to the development of that industry. But in reality, if you want to look at the real question, what relationship does that have to long-term health? None. It really doesn't work that way. In fact, we have studies now. When you do these kind of studies, using nutrient supplements compared to the same amount of nutrient in the food, the supplements actually can increase disease risk. For a number of cases, that for different nutrients, whereas the supplement or the nutrient in the case of food does not. So there's something about nature, the way it works. Here's a couple of statements from 67 total randomized trial involved. And that number of subjects, look at this. No evidence to support antioxidant supplements prevent mortality in healthy people, patients with varying disease. 2008, 5 years later, nobody's really much talking about that because we have now a multi-billion dollar industry that's telling us otherwise. So nobody hardly hears this kind of thing. Beta-carotene, vitamin A, vitamin B, significantly increased mortality. What a terrible thing. Even omega-3 fats, you know, the wonder boy of these days, the wonder nutrient. Everybody's wanting, I've got to get my omega-3 fats. Well, here's some results of 89 studies published in 2006. Omega-3 fats do not have a clear effect on total mortality, combined cardiovascular events, or cancer. Although not statistically significant, clinically important harm, actually, in the form of cancer risk, could not be excluded. In other words, people taking these supplements, the cancer risk, if anything, went up. It did go up. Didn't quite reach significance. So it begs the question, why are we relying on this stuff? 2006. Here's one for another for omega-3 fats and diabetes. This is one big study involving almost 10,000 cases. 3 million persons. This is a huge, huge study. Here's what they got when they looked at diabetes compared to the amount of omega-3 fats they consume. Taking the lowest level of diet of omega-3 fats, setting that as one as the standard. The next higher dose level increased it by 5%, increased diabetes by 5%. The next one up increased diabetes by 17%. And then the fourth one increased by 24%. Omega-3 fats to actually cause an increase in diabetes, that's pretty astounding. Even fish, 22% higher risk for diabetes when served at a higher level of intake compared to the lower level of intake. That's another story. You probably haven't heard it, but it needs to be told. It's out there. The omega-3 fats are not what we think they are, not what people think they are. The ability of omega-3 fats to do good things, and you see a lot of that, and they seem like they do, is more a function of the fact we're testing them in people who have got their diets wrong. They're living on high-fat diets, and that's almost everybody. You'd put in a little omega-3s there, you might see what looks like short-term benefits. When you get the fat intake down, like a whole food plant-based diet, they have no effect. They don't work. So, in other words, what has happened with these nutrient supplements, it tends to cause us to shunt our interest away from what turns out to be the real deal. So now let's talk about the... So those are the two assumptions. And I'd ask you just to think about it, because some of it's provocative, I'm sure. That has actually framed our discussion about nutrition over the years, and it's confused us enormously. It's caused public confusion, because everybody has their favorite nutrient or their favorite this or their favorite that or their particular disease they're interested in. And you get this result here and that result there. You know, sometimes not very big differences, except when you put them in the newspapers and talk about the differences. Then they appear to be big deals. But in any case, the promise of future nutrition, I'm saying, is nutrition is plant-based. That's because, you know, that curve of the protein thing that subsequently led to all the other studies. And so I end up with this idea here that I'm referring to nutrition as not the act, it's not the summation of individual nutrients. It's the aggregate, comprehensive effect of countless nutrients. I'm not talking about the 30 or 40 nutrients you may find in textbooks. I'm talking about the hundreds of thousands or, you know, all different. You pick the number of all these chemicals and plants that work, at least the ones produced by nature. And I use the W here, and I know the dictionaries don't spell it that way, but I'm suggesting they change their spelling. Because in science, we don't like that word holism, because that sounds fuzzy. It sounds a little bit religious and has done so. I'm really serious about this. And so even at the nub, at the core of the debate between science and religion that sometimes unfortunately occurs, it turns out that if you call it something holism in science, then that's too religious. So what really I'm talking about here, that word got misspelled somewhere way back. It should have a W in front of it. So I'm calling it holism that way. So here's what holistic nutrition is. Multiple nutrients, multiple mechanisms. I didn't show you that. Well, I'll show you in a minute, I guess. When we look for the mechanism by which protein works, every time we look for the responsible mechanism, the biochemical mechanism, we found one. So it turned out, you know, lots of different mechanisms working together. A number of diseases in the late stages, like heart disease. My good friend, Dr. Caldwell Esselstyn, for example, has shown this. Reverse heart disease in the late stages using this whole plant-based food. It's amazing. Multiple health improvements. I'm talking about physical performance with world-class athletes. We've gotten to know some who have tried this here and they get really interesting results. So it's all pointing to a whole food plant-based diet. Everything working together. You know, and to put our finger on one magic bullet of one's observation, you know, out of context, especially testing them out of context, doesn't make sense. And that's where really a lot of our problems arise. So I say the promise of future nutrition is not only plant-based, it's also holistic. That's the way it works, okay? So here's a little bit of evidence of holism, more expanding on this holism idea. Whole plant-based foods, when sustained, that is, we continue to consume them, if you will, when sustained, actually prevents, suspends, and or cures all these diseases, according to information that's been in the scientific literature for some years. And we just ignored it because we kept thinking all the time we're trying to find the specific nutrient, a specific this or that. You know, if we didn't that, we didn't pay attention to it. But in reality, when you look at the literature, as we did, and I sort of looked at it over the years, but in more formally at the time we wrote the China study, you find all of these diseases here responding the same way. Isn't that amazing? Do you know of a drug that can actually prevent, suspend, or even cure these diseases so consistently like this? It has breadth. It's amazing. It really has breadth. Another lesson, that this runs counter to what the entire medical industry is all about and what biomedical research is about, because the medical industry wants you to think, what we think, you know, you need this drug to do that. That's very reductionist, when in reality, nutrition, the whole food kind of thing, It does all these things in mysterious ways to produce a certain outcome that's very exciting. So that mechanism thing I said before, here we were trying to understand what are the things going on during the stages of cancer production, from the early stages of initiation through the subsequent stage of promotion and finally to progression. And so we looked for mechanisms. I did this in my lab over some years. Usually it took about one graduate student to work on a doctorate 4 or 5 years to look at one mechanism in some detail. And what we actually ended up was every time we looked for a mechanism, we found one. I can't get into all these details, like increasing this enzyme synthesis and activating genes and causing mutations and all this kind of stuff. During this early stage, second stage, there is no such thing. And that's just using one nutrient. Imagine all the nutrients together. We can't even begin to grasp, you know, the dynamic of these activities working together to produce the response. So in other words, nutrients act not by one, but by countless mechanisms. Okay, a little definition here I think that's worthy to consider. Countless food constituents working together, that's what whole food, plant-based nutrition is. It's holistic. Countless things working together. Many diseases prevented and reversed, the ones that I showed you just a moment ago. Nutrition is basically is greater than the sum of its parts. It's like a biological symphony. How many of you want to go see a symphony and watch one instrument pounding away on one note? Or look at a great art piece and looking at one stroke within that painting and just concentrating on the one stroke, just done time and time again. I mean, you know, whether it's art, music, poetry, it really is about the collective symphonic nature of behavior of these things. Now, getting right near the end of things, medical practice is reductionist. I know there's a serious challenge to the practice of medicine. Actually, lately, about 3/4 of my lectures are to medical schools, and I'm really gratified because the reaction I'm getting, first, I didn't get a terribly favorable reaction, I should say 4 or 5 years ago, but now, what I'm finding is that a lot of people in medicine, if I can characterize their reactions in one way more often than else, it's anger. A lot of people listen to this kind of thing, they hear this kind of thing, they try it on their patients, and they're, quite frankly, angry because they don't understand why they weren't taught this. Now, I'm going to share with you why I think that was so. So it's a reductionist thing. They want one thing, this and that. For example, we think of single causes, you know, specific genes. What this whole idea today of discovering this gene for this and that, I mean, really, it's gotten out of hand because things don't occur in 99.9% of the cases of one gene causing this mischief. It's not the presence or absence of a single gene. It's multiplicity of genes working together, and even more importantly, it has to do with the way in which those genes are expressed. That's the domain of nutrition. So we have single biomarkers. We get caught up in blood cholesterol and blood sugar. It's supposedly telling us all about our health. We look at one thing like that and get a lot of difficulty. You know, the reason we do that, by the way, when we think of this way, then we can make drugs just to knock that one thing down or that thing down. One drug. And every single drug that we ever, just essentially ever test, we ever develop and test, has side effects. And it's only dealing with a tiny little sliver of the holistic, the whole system. Single diseases, I think somewhere around 8,800 diseases now are characterized by the International Classification of Disease. This is the means by which physicians can be paid, and they have to be paid, that's obviously. So they make a diagnosis and then, you know, put the ICD code down or something equivalent, and that enables them to program the kind of reimbursement they get. But in any case, all of this encourages the discovery and use of single drugs. And those things, in turn, even though they come from plants, almost all of them do, they basically are turned into foreign chemicals. That is, you can't patent the chemical in the plant you think does a good job. They take it out and have to change it. It becomes a foreign chemical body. It causes side effects and all of that. It's a big story. So there's the China study. For those of you who have not seen it, this is what I did with my son. That was published in 2005. It's really been quite an exciting journey. I was told that if we sold 2,000 to 3,000 copies of that, we'd do well. And finally, with the publisher, that we did get involved with, he said, if you can get me 15,000 copies sold, I'll make my money and I'll be fine. Well, now it's sold over 1 million copies since that time. This is a late coming cookbook of our daughter, China City Cookbook. And this is the new book, Whole, where I'm trying to, this was sort of telling what we saw. And I don't like to, you sound like I'm preaching, I'm sure, the way I probably talk, but it's my enthusiasm. I don't really like to preach to anyone. I don't really like to tell people, you have to do that or else. That's not my style. So what we said in the China study was, here's the data, here's where I see it, you decide. And what we said, try it. That was my preference, just try it. And a lot of people have tried it since then. I have seen absolutely remarkable returns for their test of the idea. And so then I get into this book, Whole. And there's lots of ways of looking at that concept that I find really, really exciting. So we also, I should point out, for those of you who may be interested, we have an online course in plant-based nutrition and run by my foundation and associated with the Cornell link that does online courses. It's really been going very nicely. It's a kind of an interactive learning experience. Physicians can earn 30 Category 1 continuing medication credits. The public, not just physicians, are obviously taking this. About a third of our students are now physicians and the like. It's an instructor monitored thing. 3 2-week courses, not a lot, really. It's just kind of it's enough, I think, to get people interested in it. And we had about 3,000 graduates so far. It's very exciting. I just want to bring it to your attention because it's run by a nonprofit foundation. I don't get any personal compensation for this. I'm just really anxious that we use this opportunity to share with the public what, in fact, this is all about. There it is, except I got a postscript. If I was going to look, do I have a time? Oh, friend. Well, let me just show you this real quick. This little schematic is something we did, too, that kind of overlays all this. If we start in the beginning with some cells, some of which are genetically programmed to cause disease, well, in this case, a really high gene dose, we call it, compared to a small gene dose. There's a lot of genetic activity here. They're going to give more tumors, for example. We actually did this. This is what we were doing, 30, 40 years ago. And over here, you got less tumors. That's when the diet is the same for both groups. In that case, you can say, oh, genes cause disease. Yeah, they do. Everything starts with genes. You can say that. But here's a little clicker. Doesn't make a difference within some limits. It basically does not make much difference which kind of genes we have. It really is a function of what kind of nutrition we're consuming that actually controls the expression of these genes. One of the most exciting domains of nutrition in the entire biological system. We're finishing this problem here. I know Mark said something about, I was going to say something about policy. I did spend about 20 years in national policy development on food and health, and it's quite an experience to see how scientific information is translated into the public domain. And here's one thing I think we can put our finger on right now that's worth mentioning. I just this morning saw Mark Bittman's article in the New York Times, something about this. I said, I'm going to throw this in here because it really does say quite a bit. Here is basically the proportion, not a good slide, I apologize for that, but here's a pie chart of showing how much of our subsidies, this is taxpayer dollars, how much of our taxpayer dollars goes into the subsidization of food production, how much of it goes, let's say, for protein and dairy, that means meat, sweeteners and additives and grains, most of which are for livestock feeding. 99% really of our subsidies, our taxpayers, you're paying for it, our taxpayers going in to fund the production of foods that causes problems. Only 1%, only one penny out of every dollar that we have. Essentially, it goes into to those folks who are trying to improve on the production of fruits and veggies. That's pretty horrendous. But I think just that one observation right there is enough to tell us about what's going wrong in Washington, and what most of us really are unaware of. So I'm going to stop here. Be happy to take some of your questions for a while. So I think we've maybe got about 10, 15 minutes. And there's phones here or PA system. Or, yeah.
Any comments on the microbiome? Sorry, on the microbiome, the gut bacteria.
Yeah. Question you all heard. Microbiome, this has to do with the microorganisms in our intestinal tract, which are very, very important. They've been known, in fact, I did my master's thesis on just that, trying to change it from between a rabbit and a chinchilla to see if we could actually do that. So I've been very much aware of the very great importance of the bacterial flora in our intestinal tract. It does play a role. It plays a role in helping us to digest things, for example, like dietary fiber and things like that, that result in products that is helpful to our gastrointestinal tract, for starters. I mean, it is really important. We need a lot more work on that, but just to make it short, very, very important. Yeah.
What is your view on the GMOs? And when you're talking about a whole food plant-based diet, are you talking about organic vegetables, or are these genetically modified vegetables safe for consumption?
I thought I might get that question here in Connecticut. I don't like GMOs, period. You know, I've followed this literature from more or less the beginning, and what is concerning me, it comes back, here's an example of scientists thinking about things in a very reductionist manner. Namely, if I can change this gene and get this result, make a strawberry bigger or tastier or whatever, I can change this gene, get this result, that's all I need to do. Great marketing ploy. And so, foods have been changed. But tinkering with the genes in one way or another. Usually focused on one thing. Unaware of the fact that maybe hundreds of genes work together to create response. By working on one thing, this magic bullet like this, we may get the result that we desire, let's say. But what about how that disturbs all the other gene activities whose effects are not likely to be seen maybe for years? So that's why we ended up with this concept of unintended consequences. And so I'm really frustrated. I think the whole question of our society having allowed this kind of thing to go forward the way it has is a huge mistake. But now, like we used to say on the farm, the horse is kind of out of the barn. I hate to say that. But the fact of the matter is, we got now genetically modified plants and foods out there that are basically being shown possibly to contaminate some of the other species. That's not a good deal. What happens, let's say, 10, 20, 30 years from now? All of a sudden, we see an epidemic of something. And then, for some reason, we can trace it back. It was because of that. What are we going to do when that gene is spread all over the place? I think it's a very dangerous, an extremely dangerous activity that's been put on us by the corporate sector, period.
Dr. Campbell, my son was diagnosed with colon cancer at 21. And then it was determined that both of my children have this gene mutation that predisposes them to an 80% risk of getting colon cancer before the age 65. And my daughter with a high risk of getting GYN cancers. So are you saying that if they eat a plant-based diet, that they would lower their risk of cancer going forward?
That's an excellent question. It's particularly relevant to the recent discussion of BRCA1 and 2 of Angelina Jolie. The poor woman was told, very alarming information. She didn't, in her mind, have much choice because that very high, 87% in the case of breast cancer. So in answer to the question, you're talking about colon cancer. I know less about that. I've known about the BRCA1 from the day it was first discovered, incidentally. When people mothers used to call me, this is 1994, to see whether or not their 10 and 11-year-old daughters should be receive mastectomies, which I thought was really bizarre, weird. But here's my take on that, and I want to be careful about it. In the basic research that we were doing, when we created a genetically modified animal, let's say, with a high dose of a carcinogen, Now they got the gene. So we have these. This situation was a very potent gene. It's going to go out there and it's going to cause whatever it wants to cause. We find, even in that case there, when we gave them the appropriate kind of protein, for example, in that case, down to baseline. So the phenomenon of considering what genes do, even, I mean, some genes are pretty potent, let's face it. If you've got the gene, it's tough, maybe in some cases. It's going to, you know, make its way through and cause some problems, possibly. But what we're not doing in research, not telling people like Angelina Jolie, is that we have evidence now, not generally acknowledged by too many cancer people, and that was my specialty, not acknowledged that we can take that situation and put them in a really good, pristine diet and control the expression of that gene. Those who have those kind of activated genes or mutated genes, if you will, risk is higher. You know, it's a wake-up, maybe. Let's do it right, kind of thing. But I can't answer your question, whether you get the risk level all the way down to baseline. We could experimentally. And so I lecture to oncologists, by the way, in med schools, and I offer this suggestion, is that because they're not trained in nutrition, they don't even allow for this possibility.
Yeah, they laugh.
That's right. It's exactly what to do, I find it extremely frustrating. And so, and Angelina Jolie, I mean, by the way, she was claiming a couple of years ago to have been, quote unquote, a vegan. And then somehow, that was reported in the New York Times, somehow she decided along the way that she wasn't getting enough nutrition. I don't know who told her that. But she switched back to apparently a more steak-rich diet. Now she learns this here, this 87%, which incidentally is a risk that's beyond the highest range usually set.
Yeah.
So all of a sudden, this woman's being told, you know, you've got an 87% chance. You know, and what is she supposed to do? I really feel sorry for people who actually have to face that information.
Well, they wanted to take my son's entire colon out at the time, but we only had like 3 days to make a decision, so we opted not to do that. But, always a worry because they have to be screened, but they say they can miss things in the colonoscopy. But, you know, going forward, too, a complaint that's always heard with the low protein diets is you're never full. You know, it seems like you need that protein, that animal protein, either that fish or eggs or something, to feel full. I mean, do you agree with that?
Well,
I guess not.
Maybe back in the days when we were consuming a high protein, meat, milk, and eggs, like in our family, you know, and then switching over, maybe you have that feeling a little bit, can't feel full. But actually, we tend to be programmed for our preferences on taste. And also a preference for fullness, if you will. You get over here and then start eating this rabbit food. At first, you know, you're not exactly to your liking, maybe, because you're eating this high fat, you know, low fiber kind of diet. You get over here, it's not making you feel, you're not satisfying your body for what it's accustomed to. So, what we do know, what we do like this, stay with it. A little persistence. Our bodies readjust. By the time it readjusts, it might take a month or two with dietary fat. We're addicted to high-fat diets, I should say. Get over here like this, and now all of a sudden, new taste preferences begin to occur. You start sensing, feeling. You can't go back and eat that high-fat food.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, fullness. Specifically, your question. I don't know of anybody who really has been on this for a long enough period of time. And by the way, I'm not talking about vegan diets. I'm not talking about vegetarian diets. I'll mention in a moment, but I'm talking about whole food plant-based diets without added fat, salt, and sugar. Do it that way. And that's what I am learning now is probably the native diet that we mostly got here on. And when you do that, then the taste preferences change, the body adjusts, all kinds of things are going on. It's marvelous. The body's always trying to create health. The problem is we throw crap into our bodies, you know, and it has to deal with it. So, in answer to your question, I'm not going to stand here and presume or make presumptuous to say, you know, what that situation is, but I just really believe from the research perspective that going into a really good whole food plant-based diet, stay there. And I know people have done this.
Well,
nothing happens.
The oncologist at Sloan Kettering would say this was up to maybe 3 years ago. No really good studies yet that show that meat is that harmful, that it causes colon cancer. No studies that show that blueberries are going to save you from breast cancer. They really kind of, they're not onto it yet. They're not.
Yeah, I lecture at Sloan Kettering myself and have several times. The last time I went there, one gentleman, been there, some, I'm not going to use names, he got quite upset with what I was saying, and he refused to allow me to be paid my honorarium. But, you know, so I left. But in any case, the fact of the matter is, when they say this food has not been shown to do this, in reality, there's a lot of studies shown for a lot of foods, especially meat, and its relationship. But it's not really the way to talk about it. It's not even the way necessarily to study it. Because it's a totality of foods. Like, use it the whole animal food kingdom or the whole processed food, you know, domain. Compare it with this other one. You do it that way, then we see remarkable things. We have done some studies now. My son, my oldest son, has done it now twice. And some other folks have done this too. That if you take a group of 20, 25 people, that's what's been done. You control, you give them the food. We would argue very tasty food. They seem to like it. In a period as short as a week, maybe two, you can see remarkable changes. The rapidity of effect is just truly astounding. Cholesterol has come down like that. Mm-hmm. LDL cholesterol bad also plummets. Blood pressure, you know, problems for those who have those problems begin to correct themselves. People lose weight. All kinds of things happen very fast. The trick is get over here and stay there. That's the way that I think this really works.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, over here.
What's your take on vitamin B12?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked that question. Vitamin B12. We never use vitamins. Never have. Mm-hmm. Don't use drugs either. And so the vitamin B12 may be an exception. You know, and so for people consuming this kind of diet, it's true. B12 levels in serum tend to drop. It's pretty consistent. There's no question about that. And if it gets low enough, there might be some problems on occasion. That argument or that observation has been used to say that, you know, plants don't have B12, therefore you have to eat animal food. That's what some people say. And it's true. Animal food has more because cows and sheep and stuff had organisms. The B12 comes from microorganisms. And so if it's in the soil, you know, in good, rich soil and stuff like that, then we're likely to be getting enough. This story gets complicated because the B12 effect is not related just to the level of B12 being consumed. It's also related to a factor in our stomach called intrinsic factor. And if we don't have the intrinsic factor there, the B12 may not get used. So if you're on a low B12 diet, you got this problem. Yeah, B12 can go down. So I feel justified in supporting the idea of taking B12 supplements. I do. It's the only thing I do about once every, 2 weeks? Because my wife makes me take a B12 supplement. But I don't get too enthused about that.
All right. Thank you.
Yeah.
Why do you think there's such an obsession with consumption of animal protein in this country and it being perceived as being the best way to be healthy? I have to say, including naturopathic physicians who believe things like O blood type has to eat animal protein in order to be at optimum health. I've been told that as a type O, that I wouldn't lose weight if I didn't eat animal protein, that I wouldn't be strong and at my healthiest. And I don't want to eat animal protein.
Well, if it means anything to you, I'm type O. I'm supposed to eat meat. First off, the type O argument I don't support, not at all. The argument about why have we perceived the importance of protein? Protein was discovered in 1839 by a Dutch chemist, and it was a big deal. He was working with dogs, and he found out that something in that food kept these dogs alive. He isolated this nitrogen-containing substance, had to give a name to it. So he borrowed from the Greek language the word proteos, which means of prime importance. That's how the word protein came into being. It was baptized, you know, as an awesome nutrient right then. But then that was in 1839. Then during the 1800s, in the later 1800s, some of the most eminent nutritional scientists in those days were really excited about this because it meant strength. And men really wanted that, of course. It meant strength, virility, all the rest. And even it was a hallmark of civilization, according to some of the statements were made in the late 1800s. So protein has gone out with an enormously impressive resume, if you will. They stayed with us for a long time and keep on thinking all the time that we have to have this protein. It's going to give us strength. And I'm working with some world-class athletes. Now, I'm not actually working with them. They've contacted me in some cases have found that, you know, they don't need to really do that. I'm talking about strength trainers, professional football players. Gary Player, you may know, contacted me right after the book came out, and he asked me, he said, and he's now 80 years old, Gary Player, the great Hall of Fame golfer, he called me up and said, do you mind if I go on the Golf Channel and talk about your book? This is like a month after it came out, the China study. I said, help yourself. That's nice. So he did, and he has, he's really been a real champion of this whole thing in terms of creating health and making one fit. Tony Gonzalez, not quite the whole way, future Hall of Famer, football player. John Selle, if you know that name, the Spider-Man professional basketball player. You know, some of these athletes are discovering that, you know, that this whole myth about machoism is not quite right. Because they gain agility, coordination, and recovery time during the intense bouts of exercise. So anyway, it's a cultural thing. Yeah, it's a cultural thing. Yeah.
I had a question on oil, using olive oil. I know you mentioned Dr. Esselstyn, and I just wanted to find, I know he totally says to avoid oils, and I just want to get your opinion on that.
Well, Dr. Esselstyn, one of my closest friends ever, he and I, we lecture together, and he's done some just, in my view, just magnanimous work, you know, on reversing heart disease, and a very honorable fellow doing this. He has kind of taken a pretty strong stand on not having any extra oil, including no nuts.
Right.
Yeah, he kind of says that. I mean, he and I kind of argue about that a little bit. But I yield to him, in a sense, his views, because he's talking about people with serious heart disease. And so he wants to make sure they get it right. So, I'll pass on that. But, you know, for the everyday folks, I think nuts is pretty good food. It's really pretty good food. And we shouldn't be consuming whole jars of it, but, you know, whatever. It's pretty good food.
I find it difficult to find, like, let's say, hummus, things like that, that have some oil in it, to not have that as part of my diet. And
yeah, well, that's because
I've had some heart problems, more electrical system type problems, not artery problems.
Well, you're just like the rest of us. I'm going to suggest it sounds unkind almost, but you are addicted, you know, to a higher fat intake. Go down and cut it all out together. You'll see it changes.
So I think I'm better off with that, with the oil.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Yeah.
How are you, sir? Thank you for coming. Appreciate it. In regards to the last slide that you decided to put on there with the plant and with the plate and the recommended daily intakes for that the federal government believes that we should intake, right? It's very familiar to me because I work in the public school systems here in Connecticut, and I see the recommended daily intake in the same shape that you just presented to us, right? And that's unfortunate that our children are participating in that kind of a diet, right? The same aspect of a large or high protein diet mixed with carbohydrates. If you can talk about the environmental impact of the high protein diet and what's happening to our natural resources.
Let's stop right there and let me ask that question to people and get them to leave. I'm going to just take one more question, by the way. But in any case, The school children, yes, they're getting this food that's been subsidized by us, you know, as taxpayers, and it's a big industry, and it's keeping on putting on the children. It's a disgrace. That should not occur. And as far as the food, the production of high protein foods like animal foods on the environment, I have a friend who was the 26 years, I think he was the senior advisor to the president of the World Bank, Robert Goodwin by name, and he's out there now. He and his colleagues have determined that livestock production accounts for at least 51% of global warming. It's not the 18%, because it's more than 51%. What's really attractive by that idea, if true, is that the gas they're talking about in this case is methane, and that has a shorter half-life in the environment, so therefore it could dissipate faster. If we were to cut down livestock, we could actually begin to solve the global warming problem much faster than worrying about the CO2. Yeah, one more. Yes, just
first
I'm
I
sorry
want
about
to,
this. I have to wind this up.
First, I want to say thank you. A year ago, I switched to a vegan, plant-based diet, thanks largely to your work. And while I have no science background, I found it pretty convincing. Listening to you today, you talked about the difficulty of overturning a paradigm where you're being asked to connect the dots in a completely different interpretation than the prevailing interpretation. It prevails among scientists and prevails with people with financial interests, certainly. And I can see that that's very, very tough. And I applaud you for not standing back and simply asking for more researchers, which is what you said earlier on. But if you had billions of dollars to disperse for research, for grant proposals, where would you want to invest those research dollars so that scientific hypotheses, which you believe already are rather strongly demonstrated, could, assuming those are true, be even more strongly demonstrated by the accumulation of research and could contribute to the changing of this whole paradigm as scientists saw this in a different light? Epidemiological research, other types of research.
Okay, can I take that question then? Excellent question. I thank you very much. Basically, do you know this whole thing I just told you about the breadth of effect, repetitive effect, and all that kind of thing? It comes from a holistic interpretation of data, as you can tell. And unfortunately, that idea has not been fully tested, that breadth of effect and repetitive effect. Has not really been tested. Science has not done
exactly.
It. That's my concoction of taking all these threads and putting it into a tapestry, in a sense. That's what I'm doing
people
with
people change one variable at a time.
Yeah, that's right. I want to do the study. I already have it programmed. You go out and get your $1 billion. Come
right,
and see me.
Exactly. No,
I'm kidding. But the fact of the matter is, we have a lovely experiment we could do. And in 2 to 3 years' time, this is what we need to do. We need to do it professionally. I can do it in a way and get it published, and the entire country would say, all they would say is, wow. We know how to do it.
Well I'm glad you've convinced Gary Player. Now you need to convince a billionaire philanthropist, and maybe you'll have your wish.
Okay,
but I hope that's the second part of changing
the
connection of the dots.
So thank you very much. I'll be down here. That's all right.